This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.
A very warm welcome to This Is Money and Share Radio podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me in the studio is editor Simon Lambert and reporter Becky Ruck to round up this week's top stories that they've been covering on their financial website of the year. And all eyes were on Philip Hammond this week as the Chancellor delivers his first and last autumn statement. Will the public get what the public wants? A jammy deal for those just about managing, or will the money end up being spread too thin?
Lots of good news in there, I think, to help the jams. But if we look at one of the measures that was designed to help them as a headline, 30 pence rise in the national living wage, rising inflation is going to strip any benefit of that away.
Rising debt, low growth forecast, perhaps it's the Chancellor who's left in a jam.
We now have a £122 billion Brexit black hole.
So who were the winners? Who were the losers when it comes to that pound in our pocket? Good news for drivers, cyclists, car boot sellers, parents, wannabe homeowners, pensioners for now, and hurrah for savers. Say hello to the new NS&I bond with a market-leading rate of 2.2%.
The bonds will be open to people aged 16 and over, so there's an opportunity for everybody of that age to come into that product. 2.2 at the moment is a market leader.
Well, it's bad news for gym bunnies, the airport industry and lettings agents, but also perhaps renters as well.
The letting agents had to find that money because there are costs in referencing tenants and doing the admin and so on. Simply what happens is that cost is passed on through increased rent.
We also spoke a lot about Britain's productivity, 30% lower than the US and Germany, and also behind France and Italy. Could this man be to blame?
Some of you will lose your jobs, yeah. On a more positive note, the good news is I've been promoted.
Will be revealed. Now, with all that excitement, we almost forgot it was Black Friday week. Yes, Friday is not one day, apparently. It goes on forever. And yes, that was just personal wishful thinking. How could I forget about Black Friday? But how can you make sure you get a good deal? What are your rights if you do get a little bit carried away? We'll also be looking at where to put any spare cash, should you have any left over from Black Friday, from the Sublime NS&I offering we've just heard about, to the ridiculous airport parking spaces, anyone? To the super cool, an F1 car you can actually drive legally on the roads. But we are asking today, yes, the starting gun for Christmas shopping has been fired in earnest. So I want to know, have you started yours already? Does it begin in Black Friday week? Or are you not talking about it until Christmas Eve? Neither should I, so pipe down, Georgie. A very good morning, Simon.
Good morning.
Good morning, Becky. Hey. Simon, to you first. Christmas shopping, when does it start for you?
What do you think the answer to that question
is going
Simon,
to be? I reckon, you've already done it. I reckon you're busy making chutney and knitting. No, you're not.
No,
I'd say Christmas Eve at about, when do the shops shut on Christmas Eve? 5, 6? You'll be about 45 minutes beforehand.
No, I don't leave it that late. I have been known to buy presents on Christmas Eve before. 23rd or 22nd, maybe.
Forgive me, Simon.
Yeah. Look, so my birthday's on the 16th of December. So
nothing happens until
Christmas
that point.
Doesn't start until after my birthday. That's always been the rule in my family. I now actually have a daughter whose birthday is closer to Christmas. Her birthday is on the 23rd of December. But I don't think you can apply that rule when someone's birthday is on the 23rd of December, because that really is cutting it a bit fine. But no, I don't really start until after my birthday. The problem with that is it does mean that you kind of miss out a lot on the buying stuff online. And every year I think, right, this year I'm going to buy a load of this stuff online and I'm not going to have to worry about going to the shops, and then I never get round to it. And then you suddenly get to the point where you're bang on Christmas. However, this year I do have an added advantage in the form of an Amazon Prime account.
Ooh.
Yeah, so I signed up for monthly payments to Amazon Prime, basically so I could watch the Grand Tour, the Clarkson thing, to see
so
what it's like.
Nothing to do with shopping at all, really?
Nothing to do with the shopping at all, no. So I signed up to see what it's like. Well, you know, I do look after the motoring section, you know, so I thought I should see what's going on.
Do you expense that?
No. it's a nice idea, isn't it? I think that one would get turned down. But, yeah, so this year I will have the advantage of that next day delivery, but who knows?
So I just want to know, though, will you partake in Black Friday bonanza? Let's call it that.
No, I will not take part in the Black Friday bonanza. No, I will not go buy things on Black Friday. The last thing I want to do is go into a shop that's full of people. So I'd probably prefer to go on a day where they charge me more so that it wasn't so busy. However, I will tell you a funny story. My wife went to university in Leeds, as did I, and a friend of hers contacted her a few weeks back. said, do you fancy going up to Leeds for the weekend? Going to go up on the Friday, do some shopping, and then we'll meet up with our friends who still live there, go out for dinner, and then see them and their families on the Saturday, come back on the Saturday.
Lovely.
My wife, Catherine, said, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. Booked her tickets and everything on the train, leave in the morning. Nice day, Friday, shopping, maybe a few glasses of Prosecco, relaxing. She was doing some work earlier this week. She does training and development. She's doing some work for a cosmetics company, Lizelle. She was speaking to one of the people who works on the counter in Leeds and said, oh, yeah, well, I'm coming up on Friday. I'll come and see you and say hello. The woman said, yeah, you should definitely do that. And she just went, oh, except it's going to be crazy. It's Black Friday. At which point the penny dropped and my wife realised that she had arranged a shopping trip to Leeds on Black Friday.
So that lovely, relaxed
quiet
is not going to happen. We'll enjoy that, won't she? I'm sure she will. Rebecca, for you, has Christmas shopping started for you?
It has. I'm generally quite organised with it and buy lots of stuff in the summer. I've made my chutney. That's all done, stored away. Then I have a gap and I kind of quite often forget what I've bought and then have a last minute panic on Christmas Eve. But Black Friday, I think actually less people have been going to the shops this year compared to normally you get the videos of people fighting over a TV and getting really stressed out. I think people are looking online. I do 99% shopping online because the thought of going into a shop around Christmas time is too stressful. It's just too many people. It's too aggressive. I think just do it online. Amazon Prime, it's free. It's there the next day.
I just think the whole thing's really stressful. I don't like
it.
I don't like shopping. I don't like Black Friday. Don't know anything about it.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Share Radio, the team from the finance website of the year, This Is Money, are back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up in partnership with NS&I. And I'm joined today by editor Simon Lambert and reporter Becky Rupp. Now, a ton of debt, lower growth, more borrowing. The outlook for wages and living standards also pretty bleak. Yes, we've got some sobering insights into the state of the country's finances this week as Chancellor Philip Hammond delivered his first and last autumn statement. Six wasted years or just gloom and doom mongering?
The Prime Minister and I, Mr Speaker, remain firmly committed to seeing the public finances return to balance as soon as practicable, while leaving enough flexibility.
We now have a £122 billion Brexit black hole. That's the difference. So basically, we had borrowing figures in March where the government said this is how much we expect to borrow over the next few years. Then we have the Brexit referendum. The government's now saying over the next 5 years they're going to borrow an extra £122 billion. And that difference, that figure, is higher than expected. The city were expecting something like £100 billion extra borrowing, now up to £122.
Share Radio senior analyst Ed Bauscher there. It's OK. Economic forecasting, though, it's not a precise science, and it's good to prepare for a rainy day, so says the Chancellor. Many Eurosceptic MPs, such as Jacob Rees-Mogg, also not happy.
Assuming the government is sensible and gets us out of the customs union and we're free to set our own tariffs, then happy days are here again. So Brexit is terrific, and these forecasts will turn out to be wrong.
Oh, goody. As well as the bigger economic picture, though, the autumn statement also contained with it a number of measures that, of course, affect that pound in our pocket. Before we get on to that and the winners and the losers, Rebecca, I'm going to come to you first, if that's all right. What did you make of his style before we get to the substance? Are we thinking rabbits out of the hat, some magician's work, or was it steady as she goes, something to set the agenda, the tone going forward?
There weren't many rabbits out of the hat. I think I always get to about 45 minutes in and think, this is going to be the point. Something's going to happen. There wasn't really. And it was a very different style to George Osborne. Much calmer, less kind of quick attention-grabbing headlines, I think.
There were some humorous moments or jokes.
Were
some less
humorous?
Intended than the others, I think.
Yeah, I think the Strictly mention. And a lot of Pride and Prejudice mention was in there too. I think that we can do without that stuff. I think that it's too important really to be trying to be a bit of a joker. But I think it was, on the whole, quite calm. Nothing too big that was announced, really.
OK, well, let's take a closer look at the economy. The Chancellor told us the deficit would no longer be cleared by 2020. We got that. The OBR reckon the government would have to borrow £122 billion more than forecast in March's budget, with the Brexit result accounting for around about £60 billion of this. Plus, that vote meant potential growth in the current Parliament would be 2.4% lower than forecast in March. And we also have the itty-bitty matter of a £1.6 trillion pounds worth of debt. Simon, firstly, Economics 101, debt, borrowing, deficit, what does it all mean? Go.
Well, our deficit, that is the sum of money by which we fail to balance the books each year. So if you were to relate this to the idea of household spending, then ideally you want to spend what you earn and maybe save some money as well. Unfortunately, we live beyond our means. We can't actually afford to pay for everything, so we have to borrow money each year in order to keep ourselves afloat. Now, there is an argument that you can't compare economies and household spending, because for economies, you should in some ways borrow if you're using that to do things that are going to boost growth, build some new infrastructure and fix things, because that stimulates economic growth and that will therefore lead to more tax coming in. So it becomes a virtuous circle. You can probably compare that to the kind of idea of long-term borrowing that you use to buy a house or something like that. There is a gain from that. The debt is the money that we owe, quite simply, and our debt is rising
quite
substantially.
Sizeable.
Yes, it's quite sizable, yeah. Yes. But we're not the only people with quite sizable debts. The Americans have very sizable debts. And in fact, many countries around the developed world do have very, very sizable debts and made a sort of attempt to try and pay down some of this debt after the financial crisis. And broadly speaking, haven't really managed to pay back much of it at all. For us, it's not so much of an issue. Our borrowing costs are low. We are able to essentially print money because we're in control of our own currency. And so we can have things like quantitative easing. And so the idea that Britain would ever default on its debts is quite far-fetched, because we've got no need to default on our debts because we can just create more money to pay them. The only worry is if people decide that we are going to start diluting the value of our money so much that their investments they have with us will be paid back in money that's not really worth that much, then they get worried. And in terms of borrowing is the amount of money that we need to borrow in order to keep ourselves afloat and pay those debts.
OK, so you say it's not too bad and it's all right. They're worse than we are. But it all in all doesn't really sound great. The OBR, being overly pessimistic, if some have argued, I mean, what are they basing this on? Gloom and doom, or is it actually fine? Jacob Rees-Mogg seems particularly happy with everything.
He's had a good Brexit, hasn't he, old Jacob Rees-Mogg? Yeah. He has. He's everywhere. He's absolutely everywhere. I mean, he's quite charming, isn't he? He's just come across as very nice. But I think that he does also sometimes come across as just putting a gloss on things from the way that he wants to look at it. And if you're Jacob Rees-Mogg, then you think Brexit is fantastic. So you will dismiss out of hands any claims that it will cause any form of economic damage whatsoever. And in the clip there, he was talking about the fact that as long as we get ourselves out of the common market, then things will be absolutely fine, which is a fairly opposite view to what many people think, which is that the one thing that we do want to do is stay in the common market so that we can continue to trade tariff-free with Europe and also not have to go around negotiating all of these individual trade deals. So it depends what side of the fence you sit on that argument. On one side, there's this argument that this independent Britain, completely detached from the EU, will be much more nimble and out there, this plucky little fighter doing deals left, right and centre, getting on with it, making lots of money, great trading nation and all that. And then on the other side of the coin, you have people saying, well, actually, one of the things we do need to do is retain access to the single market, because that is the world's largest free trade bloc. It's quite important. They worry about cutting all these deals with the rest of the world. All we've got to worry about is making sure that we meet those standards and stay part of that market. But the IFS thing is interesting because really, it's not really talking about Brexit. What it's talking
this
about...
This is suggesting people will be earning less in real terms than they did in 2008 and families facing the biggest squeeze
since the 2008
is
the key, year in there, OK? We're talking about the after effects of the financial crisis. When the financial crisis hit, I remember Mervyn King, then Bank of England governor, talking about this idea of a lost decade, that the aftermath of the financial crisis, which came about because everybody borrowed stupendous amounts of money on an absolute explosion of cheap credit, an unprecedented explosion of cheap credit. What they were effectively doing is borrowing growth from the future. And if you borrow all that growth from the future, one day the bill's going to come. And the bill came with the financial crisis. The idea was the decade after that was just going to be pretty much lost to all of the countries who'd suffered from that. And we've kind of seen that. So people's wages have not risen in real terms, i.e. adjusted for inflation, since 2008. And the suggestion is that it's not going to be until 2021 where people are as well off as they were in 2008. That's then being compared to the longest period of wages not rising in real terms since the 1920s. However, what Paul Johnson of the IFS was keen to stress was that he was not saying that we were worse off than we were in the 1920s.
Yeah.
And he said, clearly, we are better off than we were in the 20s, you know, the 70s, the 80s, all that kind of stuff. But it's this slowdown. And I think what we've come to is the point where, up until probably the financial crisis, we all believed that every year we would, on aggregate, get richer and get wealthier. And there's this idea that every generation would be wealthier than their parents' generation. And now that's looking like it might not actually happen.
But isn't the reality, though, we are still acting like we're getting richer? I mean, we're hearing today the British Bankers Association saying consumer credit up, we're racking up debt at the fastest pace since the pre-crash boom year, 7% year on year, Rebecca. We're spending gung-ho, aren't we? Not just on Black Friday, it seems.
I think we are. To be honest, in the last 5 months, it's been very interesting period because people, I think there's so much uncertainty over what's going to happen. I mean, that was a real buzzword in the Autumn Statement this week, uncertainty over the future. People are nervous because they don't really know. And I think there's also an attitude of Black Friday, people are going to go and spend, they're going to bury their head in the sand. But I think on the whole, people are being a bit more sensible than they were in previous years.
But the reality is our economy needs us to spend, doesn't it, Simon?
Yes, and the British consumer does have a tendency to show remarkable resilience to bad news. Whilst businesses are worrying about things going wrong and, you know, they're all delaying a decision on this, delaying a decision on that, maybe spending a little bit less money on that. I mean, businesses haven't invested as much as they should have done since the financial crisis. That's one of the reasons we have this productivity problem that Mr. Hammond also talked about. The British consumer, on the other hand, you know, whilst potentially being a little bit more cautious, as Becky was saying, is still pretty keen to buy those sofas and new cars and new TVs. And hey, if your wages aren't going up, money's cheap, borrow it.
Simon, to use probably a bad analogy, think of like a boxing ring if we're getting in Brexit and the battles that are ahead. How are we looking conditionally wise? Are we ready for it? Are we up for it? Is the country pumped, match fit, good to go?
Well, I mean, if you compare it to the forecast before the vote of what was going to happen if we voted to leave, then, yeah, we look pretty match fit. We've kind of shrugged it off and gone, yeah, whatever. Come on, we're going to keep going. But you're not really... It's what happens over the next year or so. It's what happens when businesses start to see things slow down slightly. It's what happens when this effect of it, if every single business just delays a decision to expand or buy that new piece of machinery that's going to make its workers' lives easier and make it easier to produce whatever it produces, or to go out and make that acquisition of another company, or spend that bit of money on marketing and things like that. It's when you take all of that in aggregate that it starts to squeeze on the economy. And it's too early, really, to see that. What we haven't had is this fall off a cliff edge that had been predicted. But going back to the IFS thing, I think what they're suggesting is the problem is that we were already trying to haul ourselves back from the financial crisis, and we were just about managing to do that, and now we've landed the uncertainty and the costs of Brexit on top of that. And so what we've done is we've delayed the full recovery for a bit longer. Now, that's their view, and there's plenty of other people who hold an opposite view and say, no, actually, this will be good for us. This could actually accelerate our recovery. And what will happen is we will be able to turn around in 2020 or 2021 and see which one of those parties was right. But trying to forecast which one is right now is, as with any forecasts, a mug's game.
It is indeed. But Simon, you beautifully set the scene now. So we're going to delve into the substance of the Autumn Statement, if that's all right. Now, we know the government is in £1.6 trillion worth of debt. So naturally, billions to be spent on infrastructure and our flagging productivity. Chancellor Hammond is creating a new National Productivity Investment Fund to spend £23 billion between 2017 and 2022 with a focus on housing, research and development. You have to speculate to accumulate. Perhaps we need to do something. We're lagging behind France and Italy. So where is this money coming from, Simon?
We're probably borrowing it, I would imagine. Because, I mean, we don't have any other money. So we're already borrowing to pay for everything else. So we're probably borrowing to pay for this. But this is arguably the right thing to do.
OK, so where's it going then?
So where it's going to go to is it's going to go into things that are going to make us more productive. Now, why does that matter?
It's not we're lazy. What do we mean when
no.
we talk about productivity?
So when we talk about productivity and about workers becoming more productive, what we're not talking about is people getting their asses in gear and stopping using Facebook all day and actually doing some work. Although there probably is an element of that. Productivity is basically to do with making it so that when a person goes to work, they are able to produce more. And what Philip Hammond said is basically it takes a UK worker 5 days to do what a German does in just four. Now, what that means is that basically you get paid less. So this is beneficial for workers, because if you can produce more things in less time, your company can earn more money. And if your company can earn more money, it can eventually pay you more money. Maybe, hopefully.
I mean, theory.
Some of it's going to go to those shareholders and to the bosses and stuff like that. But, you know, it does reward. In aggregate, it rewards everyone. How do you boost productivity other than getting off Facebook? What you do is you invest in things that make it easier for your staff to do their job quicker and more effectively. So if you took the classic example of a factory, within that factory, you have the workers. Now, you could produce more things by just getting more workers. Easy way of doing it. And broadly speaking, that's what a lot of companies have done. They've invested in just getting in more people. And the reason why they do that is because people are cheap. You can get them in, you pay them the money, and if it doesn't work out that you're making more money, you just get rid of them again. Your other option is to invest in the machinery in the factory to basically improve the things that the workers are using so that the same number of workers can produce more things in the same amount of time. But that costs money. And also the problem is if you go out and you retool your whole factory and actually it turns out that you're not making any more money or things take a turn for the worse, you've got all these pesky machines that you've paid all this money for. Mm-hmm. And unlike workers, you can't just get rid of them very quickly and get rid of the cost. So we've seen businesses not invest as much as they should have done. But then there's also all the other things. So you've built these things in your factory. Well, what are you going to do with them now? You need to sell them to someone. How are you going to sell them to someone? Well, you need to get them out of your factory and you need to get them to the wholesaler, for example. Well, they're probably going to have to go by road or by rail. But if our roads are falling apart and congested, if our railways are not working properly, if we don't have the links that we need, you can't get those things to where they need to get to quickly. And if you can get those things to places where you need to get to quickly, then it saves you money, you can become more productive. Then you look at things like ports, the airports that we have, even things like, we talked about this Oxford to Cambridge expressway. Now, what they want to do is basically put a fast road between Oxford and Cambridge. Oxford and Cambridge aren't very far apart. I think it's 67 miles as the crow flies. But if you want to drive between the two, it'll take you a long time. If you want to get a train between the two, that'll be at least two changes all the way into London, all the way back out, almost 3 hours, and it'll cost you £53. Now, these are the sort of centres of our brightest minds. There's a lot of really interesting tech stuff coming out of there at the moment, especially around sort of medicine and medical technology. And the idea is what we should be creating is this entire band across the country, this kind of like our version of Silicon Valley, rather than our version of a load of people sat in a traffic jam or taking a very expensive long train ride into London and back out. Similar to if you look at what they call the motorsport corridor up towards Birmingham from around the sort of Milton Keynes area, which is where all of the Formula One teams are. And that then spreads out and you get lots of little businesses setting up there, supplying stuff to them. It benefits the rest of the car industry that runs up. And the car industry in the sort of the Midlands and that motorsport corridor is a prime example of what you can do to improve productivity, because lots of these businesses invest loads of money in R&D and new tools and in getting the best people and in getting places from A to B quickly and in being close to other people that do similar things. And if we could do that all around the country, then the idea is that we could make things in the same time as it takes the Germans to make them, and then we can be rich like the Germans.
We can but hope. So more machines, better tech, housing, better roads, railways, ports, Chancellor, $4.7 billion on science and innovation, $2 billion on research and development, $2.6 billion on transport networks, $1 billion digital infrastructure. But what I really want to know, Simon, is can we really blame this man?
Some of you will lose your jobs, On a more positive note, the good news is I've been promoted. When you laugh, your brain releases endorphins, Let's try that. Hey? Just. Come on, trust me, you'll feel.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely right. Everybody, I want you to laugh really hard. Let's lighten the mood. No. What am I talking about? David Brent-style bad bosses are apparently holding the country back with mismanagement. So if we sort that out in these measures to boost productivity, could we therefore be working the same as Germany, or indeed France and Italy as well? We have a new management czar. Who he? Former John Lewis boss Sir Charlie Mayfield. Simon, take a bow. This is money for linking it to David Brent. But what are we talking about here?
Well, the idea is that you need management skills. You need good managers. To get the best out of people, you need good managers, and you need people to work as a team. And if people work as a team and people have good managers, then they're more productive.
Right.
The idea is that we take the best ideas that there are out there, hopefully filter out all of the management speak that you normally get in a lot of this stuff, and explain to people in a clear and simple fashion how they can do little things that make them better bosses.
Rebecca, you had a perfect opportunity there to say how amazing Simon was. I'll give you a second bite of the cherry
there.
Sorry, should we start that again? Bad bosses, clearly something you don't experience,
Rebecca. Well, I've got an excellent boss. But I think there's, you know, the language, that kind of management speak, meetings about meetings, everyone can name some of it. I think just getting to the problem of getting things done in a clear way, making sure that the people under you or what they're talking about, just getting things done is what it's all about.
That was reporter Rebecca Rutt, editor Simon Lambert from This Is Money. And it's time to focus on the winners and the losers, the pound in our pocket, and yep, the jam, just about managing. Did the public get what the public wants? We'll find out.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NSandI.com, helping you keep on top of your savings whenever, wherever.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Share Radio, the team from the finance website of the year. This Is Money, back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up in partnership with NSandI. And I'm joined today by editor Simon Lambert and reporter Rebecca Rutt. Now, we're talking autumn statement. Who were the winners? Who were the losers? And what about that pound in our pocket? But let's start with the positives, shall we? The big winners were savers, pensioners, wannabe homeowners, taxpayers, motorists, tenants, parents, workers on benefits, and those on the lowest wages and those being made redundant.
A Tory government gave a pay rise to over a million of the lowest paid workers. We are the government that introduced 15 hours a week of free childcare for all 3- and 4-year-olds and will double that for working families from September. And we, Mr. Speaker, are the government that pledged to invest in our NHS, and we are delivering on that promise. Backing the NHS 5-year forward view plan for the future with £10 billion of additional funding by the end of 2020-2021. But we recognise that more needs to be done to help families make ends meet and to ensure every household has opportunities to prosper. So today I can announce that the national living wage will increase from £7.20 to £7.50 in April next year. That's a pay rise worth over £500 a year to a full-time worker.
That was our Chancellor there, but would all this be enough to make a difference to the jams or the just about managings?
There was lots of good news in there, I think, to help the jams. But don't forget here, if we look at one of the measures that was designed to help them as a headline one, and that was the 30 pence rise in the national living wage here, we know that rising inflation is going to strip any benefit of that away, which is why the Chancellor's leaving other measures held back, I think, to help if the economy encounters stronger headwinds down the line.
Senior political analyst at De Havilland there, Mike Indian. So let's focus on some of these first, shall we? Before we do anything, Becky, who are the jams?
Just about managing. I have to say, I love this. Like, on the day, we went and got Jammy Dodgers in.
Oh, very good.
I know, like, anything jam-related, but there wasn't actually a huge mention of it in the statement. But I think the people, so winners, we've got tenants.
We will go on to them
in much more detail.
You are going far too fast for us. Just wanted to know, generally, have the jams been helped? Because we've been hearing so much about it. It's, you either love it or you hate it. I know that's Marmite. But jam, what does it actually mean?
So it's kind of just those, it's trying to help middle-income people, helping families. And I think when you look at the statement, lots of things did help them. Some things didn't go far enough. But I mean, like, that's trying to help those, like, working families at home.
Well, we will go into more detail now. So let's focus firstly, though, on savers, shall we? Much needed help there. At least some solid good news after what's been, I mean, months of punishing cuts, but it's been going on for a lot longer than that. But specifically, NS&I will be launching a new bond set to become a market leader. Here's Chris Dowsett from NS&I with what we know so far.
The new bonds will come on sale in the next financial year, which was 2017-18. They'll be available online from nsni.com for 12 months, so no hurry to go in there once they come on sale. They will be on sale for 12 months, and the indicative interest rate will be 2.2%. The bonds will be open to people aged 16 and over, so there's an opportunity for everybody of that age to come into that product. The minimum investment of that product is £100 and the maximum investment is £3,000. It's a three-year fixed-term bond, so once you put your money in, you won't be able to access the money again for that 3 years. The 2.2% is indicative, and obviously the precise rate will be confirmed nearer to launch, expected to be in the budget in the spring. But 2.2 at the moment is a market leader for that product, so we'll see what happens when the confirmed rate is an announced come the budget.
Becky, 2.2%.
Sounds great, doesn't it?
Salivating over that. But market leader, what do you reckon to this?
To be honest, rates have been so awful for so long that the thought of it sounds great, but really 2.2% is pretty rubbish. I think it will be really popular. I think whenever NS&I have launched a savings bond like this before, they've sold out pretty much straight away. I think people will see the rate, think it's great, go straight for it, and it'll go quickly. However, it's not great. It's, and when you look at inflation, like, it's not, people are not really going to get that much money. But it's just
worse. Their hands are somewhat tied, though, aren't they? They can't offer something too stupendous.
They can't. It would be nicer if it had been, I don't know, let's say 5%. That was what I would have liked.
Obviously. We'll look at how you get potentially 8% a little bit later, but you might have to get involved with car parking. But in terms of age as well, I know the NS&I and their pensioner bond came into a bit of flack. So at least now this is something for everyone.
It is, yeah. And it's kind of, it's trying to reach out to the people who, they've got savings, there's nowhere to put that, they're losing money compared to inflation. It's good, but it's not good enough, is what I would say.
Harsh. OK, then, we're going to move on to the other winners. Pensioners. For two reasons. One, pension cold calling. Could this be the end of? And triple lock will stay for now.
I think pension cold calling and end to that is amazing. I think it shouldn't stop at pensions, though. There's so many different companies who, well, we get them all the time. I think that there should be a blanket wide ban on all cold callers. But no, for pensioners, it's great. Like, people calling you up trying to scam you out for a pension is awful. We get stories all the time about people losing their life savings. That's a really positive move.
Triple lock to stay for now, though. Doesn't look like it will stay for much longer. Perhaps March budget is when
we could
see it.
It's not very certain. I think it's kind of a wait and see. I predict it won't stay, but I think there was no guarantees on that.
Other measures, workers. Now, the national living wage will rise from £720 an hour to £750. That's from April 2017. The amount of benefits that claimants can keep while in work will increase. Redundancy as well. The first 30,000 of termination payments will remain tax-free. Tax-free childcare, fuel duty frozen as well. Anything in there that caught your eye? All of it?
Well, yeah. Well, they were all pretty positive things. To be honest, the one that I was quite angry about was the insurance tax. I mean, that's going to affect everyone who pays insurance. Their bills are going to go up again.
We'll get on to the losers in a minute.
I know. I just can't be positive.
Here. Is there any good news?
Fuel duty frozen. That's great. The whole thing,
honestly,
really.
If only there's cameras in here, your face is just a picture. All right, Simon, any positivity from you? Let's talk about housing, shall we? We'll talk about the help for renters in a moment, but what about these new homes being built? £7.2 billion will support the construction of new homes, including spending by housing associations. A new £2.3 billion housing infrastructure fund will be established for infrastructure for up to 100,000 new homes in high-demand areas. The Helped by Equity Loan scheme and Helped by ISA are to remain in force. Help for first-time buyers.
He's also spending £1.4 billion constructing 40,000 affordable homes. So that's homes that are within the reach of more people. The average house price at the moment means a lot of people just can't get on the property ladder. So he's trying to have a look at that. 40,000 homes sounds like a lot. It's a drop in the ocean, really, compared to what's needed.
We're hearing the right words. They seem to be coming from the right place, and they seem to be receptive to slightly different ideas and to changing the focus from home ownership slightly. But equally, the budget has been somewhat underwhelming. It hasn't come up with any really innovative, groundbreaking ideas that lead you to think that there's going to be a real transformation in the housing challenge, which is what the Chancellor referred to it as.
Oh, it's property lawyer Jeremy Raj there, and before that, personal finance expert Kevin Pratt. Clearly not too impressed. Simon, what are your views here?
Well, building more homes, that's the key thing, isn't it? It's mm-hmm. like, are we going to achieve that? Who knows, basically. There's been some money set aside for this. Is it enough? We build about 160,000, 170,000 homes a year. Some estimates say that we need to build 250,000, so we're missing around 80,000 a year already, and we're going to build an extra 40,000 over a certain amount of time, affordable ones, but then another 100,000 elsewhere. It's over a long period. Is that going to make much of a dent? If you look at the statistics, then actually what you see is there has been a big decline in council housing, local authority, public housing. So housing associations do a bit. Most of it is done by private companies. Can you force private companies to build more homes? You can try and make it easier for them to do it. You can try and make it quicker for them to do it. But ultimately, you've got a whole bunch of house builders that were lucky not to go bust after the financial crisis, who are being quite prudent with their finances. And they're not really going to take kindly to being pushed into building more homes recklessly. So it's a tricky one. This infrastructure fund is interesting because is it going to be to put in place all the things that stops people saying that they can have more homes in their area? Because these high demand areas we're talking about the ring around London, for example, where if you go out and you speak to people there, they get accused of being NIMBYs, but ultimately they don't trust the authorities to put in place the things that they need because at the moment there aren't enough school places already. Standing room only on the train, the roads are all blocked. Most of the hospitals have been closed down, and whereas you once would have had an A&E within 10 or 15 minutes of your house, you now have to drive across the county. So until you put in place all of those things, people aren't going to support more homes in their area. So is this what this infrastructure fund's going to go on? I'm not entirely sure.
Oh, okay, you two. Goodness me, that was supposed to be the winners. I'm getting on to the losers now, but oh dear, oh dear. Okay, well, it wasn't good news for, well, I was going to say for some people, but for everyone, sounds like. But a bad statement for savers using drawdown pensions, those with foreign pensions, insurance policy holders, house buyers, tax perks, tax avoidance schemes users, and landlords, letting agents and buy-to-let investors again coming into the crosshairs. The Chancellor banning letting fees, something that's already in place in Scotland, but it could have unintended consequences. So says Russell Quirk, CEO of eMove.
I think as we've seen in Scotland, really, where this particular policy was enacted about 3 years ago, all that happened was that the letting agents had to find that money because there are costs in referencing tenants and doing the admin and so on. So simply what happens is that cost is passed on through increased rent. In fact, as I understand it in Scotland, simply all the agents did was to charge via the landlord a higher first month's rent. A proportion of that then goes back to the agent as a landlord letting fee, which is not proposed to be unlawful. So really, I think all we've done really is really sort of move the deck chairs about a little bit. The irony is, though, the reason there is a shortage of properties is, again, because the government have not done enough to provide enough houses either for sale or indeed build to rent. So for the government now to be sort of penalising the letting agent sector, as they have landlords over the last couple of years and the last couple of budgets, is a bit ironic. The government actually hold the key to the solution to this in terms of providing more supply. And it will take certainly more than 40,000 additional affordable homes over the next 3 to 5 years to make any dent, really. We need to make a huge concerted effort, certainly on the part of the government, house builders, the planning system and so on, to build another 100,000 houses a year. And that's no easy feat, yeah, but we have done it before.
Okay, Russell Quirk there, CEO of eMove, wanting more homes built, but also talking about the law of unintended consequences with regard to these banning of letting fees. Simon, some of these can be as high as £500, but do you reckon that landlords or letting agents will just pass it on to the landlords, who'll then pass it on to us or the tenant?
No, I don't buy that, and mm-hmm. I'll explain why.
Okay.
So, first thing that happened on Wednesday morning after it leaked that this was what was going to happen was there was an absolute rush of people, mainly with fairly vested interests, to declare that this was going to backfire and all that was going to happen is that these costs would be passed on to landlords who just raised their rents and tenants would end up paying anyway. Now, I'll explain to you why I don't think that's going to happen. Firstly, so these are fees being charged by some agents, and the key word here is some, okay? So some agents have been basically profiteering on this. And when you go to rent a property, they will charge you some money for basically taking out a tenancy agreement, referencing and credit checks and all those other things. Now, instead of simply passing on the cost of the reference or passing on the cost of the credit check, they've been ramping it up. And while something might cost them £40, they charge the tenant £80. But then also they've been charging things like, they'll say, so it's for setting up the tenancy. But they're already charging the landlord for that. The landlord already pays for it. So there's been a lot of double charging and there's been a lot of ramping up prices by some agents, mm-hmm. OK? Some agents. Mainly this was a London thing and a big university town thing. And then it started to spread a bit to other high street agents because people looked at it and went, that's a nice little earner, isn't it? And that's what it was. It was a nice little earner for them. And unfortunately, because some agents have been doing this, basically it's meant that all agents are going to be banned from even passing on costs fairly, which is unfortunate, but it does at least call time to this little racket that's been going on. Mm-hmm. But the reason why I don't think this will be directly passed on is this. Basically, this money doesn't go to the landlords, OK? So it's not being taken off the landlords. The landlords are the people who decide whether to put up rent or not. It goes to the letting agents. Now, the letting agents could decide that they're going to try and claw back this lost revenue by charging it to the landlord, by raising the fees that they charge the landlord, at which point the landlord might then pass it on to the tenant. Or alternatively, the landlord might tell them that they're not paying that, because the landlord is also equally right to be angry about being double charged for things. They're being charged for things that the tenant's also being charged for. And the landlord has plenty of choice. The lettings business is a crowded market. You take a walk down any high street and you'll find 5 or 10 people who'll let your home for you. And if you're a landlord and your letting agent tries to do this to you, if they can't explain exactly what these fees are for, exactly why they need to add them on, and exactly why you're not paying for them already, my response would be to say, well, I'm not paying and I'm going to go ask that guy down the road whether they'll charge me less. And I guarantee you that if you go down the street and you ask all of those people, eventually you'll come to one who'll charge you less. And if you don't want to use a high street agent, you can use like a more bespoke letting agent, an individual private letting agent who'll really look after you and your property. Or alternatively, you can just go online. There's pressure from the online agents at the moment who'll do things for a fraction of the cost. And they will, and you can just go to them and save money. And this doesn't look to me like a market that's ripe for letting agents just being able to claw back this money by passing it on to landlords who'll pass it on in rent. It looks to me like letting agents have pricing power when it comes to tenants, because if you're a tenant and you want to rent a home, you have no choice but to rent it through the agent it's up to let with. But if you're a landlord and you want to lay out your home, you've got tons of choice of letting agents. And I have some examples of the fees if you want to see them.
Go on, what are they?
Right, so Foxton's, London-centric estate agent Foxton's,
yep.
still has its fees for tenants up on its website, or still had its fees for tenants up on its website yesterday. So it also has its fees for landlords. If you're a landlord and you're using Foxton's lettings and management service, finds you tenants, manages property, you pay 20.4% commission to the agent based on the total rent over the entire rental term. And the first 2 years' worth of renewals, this commission is 14.4%. So basically, first year, you're paying 20% commission, right? Foxton says, this is a fixed cost fee that can cover a variety of works, depending on the individual circumstances of each tenancy, including, but not limited to, negotiating the tenancy, verifying references and drawing up contracts. But then it also charges tenants a £420 fee upon creation of a legally binding tenancy agreement. Foxton says, this is a fixed cost fee that can cover a variety of works depending on the individual circumstance of each tenancy, including but not limited to conducting viewings, negotiating the tenancy, verifying references and drawing up contracts. Can you notice any difference between what those two things are apparently being charged for? Because I'm reading it here, and the only thing that there is a difference for the tenants, that literally, it literally describes it as being charged for exactly the same things, apart from for the tenants, bizarrely, who apparently are also being charged for conducting viewings. So you're being charged, as a tenant, part of your £420 fee is going on the fact that Foxton's has deigned to show you around a property that you might let.
But Simon, how else are they going to afford those plush 60s-ish chairs and the fridges full of still and sparkling water? Other losers, though, in the autumn statement, we'll briefly run through those. Salary sacrifice, perks as well as the annual allowance for saving into a pension for those who've started to draw down their pension savings will be cut to £4,000 from £10,000. Changes to the tax treatment of foreign pensions. I know one that's really got Becky going. The insurance premium tax to rise from 10 to 12%. Of course, perhaps the biggest loser was the autumn statement itself.
This is my first autumn statement as Chancellor. After careful consideration and detailed discussion with the Prime Minister, I have decided that it will also be my last. Mr. Speaker, I am abolishing the autumn statement.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
And with that, we say goodbye to the autumn statement. Hello to Black Friday. With all that focus on the Chancellor, you could be forgiven for forgetting about Black Friday. No, I'm only joking. Of course you couldn't forget about it. Don't be fooled as well. Firstly, by the fact it's called Friday, it's not even remotely one day. Amazon's had a 12-day run-up. This is Black Friday week at the bare minimum. Then we have, of course, Cyber Monday. This mad post-Thanksgiving American tradition is to signal the real starting gun to Christmas shopping, with shoppers expected to spend more than £2 million a minute, half of that online. Paul Firth from Amazon says having the big discounts now actually makes more sense than the post-Christmas sales.
Retailers tend to offer customers deals after Christmas, whether that's Boxing Day deals or January sales. But when customers really need deals, when we all want deals, is now to start our Christmas shopping.
But love it or hate it, and indeed many retailers can't stand it, it is here to stay. It's likely to get bigger. So if you do get a bit swept up in it, Rebecca, what are your rights of return?
So the first thing is, be calm today and this whole week. It depends what you're doing. If you're buying online and if you're buying in a shop, it's different. It's 14 days online as standard, 28 in a shop. However, some stores it'll be higher. So just double check before you buy. I mean, the worst thing is if you go out today, go crazy, spend loads of money, and then realise you might not be able to return it. Say things are in the sale. If it's not faulty and you just decide you don't like it anymore, you might not be able to return it. So before you... Hopefully you haven't already spent all your money. But just double check. And I think if you're online as well, just make sure the site is genuine. I mean, it's a time when millions of people are going out shopping. Fraudsters are going to be targeting people through emails, through fake websites. Just be on your guard. And before you just hand off your cash or put your card details in, just double check and make sure if something's too good to be true, it's fake. It probably is.
So if you do have any money left over after the mad Black Friday spending spree, where to put it? We've heard, of course, about the new NS9 bond, 2.2%. Nice, but what about 8%? Tempting an airport parking space. A good investment, perhaps? Simon, this old chestnut's come round again, has it?
It has, yes. It came round again due to the large number of emails that a certain person was getting advertising airport parking spaces that were an opportunity that were too good to miss.
Okie dokie. Yeah. And are they an opportunity that's too good to be missed?
Well, I've bought six.
Yeah?
No, not really.
Glasgow, Manchester, Stansted.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just covering the whole country. I'm not even going to rent them out. I'm just going to keep them there in case I need to park.
What is this?
It's basically, the idea is that you buy your airport parking space and that there will always be demand for airport parking, and you can then get a rental return from people paying to park. Now, what you don't do is operate your own one-man band parking operation whereby you stick a little machine in your parking space, or you have to stand there at the parking space charging people. It's essentially a parking space in a big car park. Now, the key to this is that you're not buying a car parking space at Luton Airport, for example, in the official Luton Airport car park. I don't think even Luton Airport does that. And they're pretty much a rackety airport, if you ask me.
Right.
You're buying one with a private parking company kind of off-site, and you're promised this return. But when you look into these things, there's things like guaranteed return, 8% a year. You're being told you're going to get a high level of return. You might be being told it's guaranteed. You might be being told that this car parking space is worth X amount, the open market value. You'll always be able to sell it on. You could maybe make a capital gain when you sell it on to someone in years to come. I would treat anything like this with a massive pinch of salt. In fact, an entire salt cellar.
Said, if it sounds too good, it probably
sounds
is.
To be good to be true, it probably is. Can you sell this on to someone? Who's going to want to buy it off you? You know, what happens if that parking company running the car park goes bust? Is this really guarantee? Guarantee is only as good as the people offering you the guarantee. All those other things. And people who email you offering you car parking spaces, I'd avoid them, to be perfectly honest.
Before I let you go, Simon, one more car story. If you don't want to invest in a car parking space, you do want to invest in something pretty cool, you can own your own Formula One race car and you could drive it on the road. What is this about?
This is a brilliant story. This is a car that is up for auction at Bonhams' auction in December, and it's called the F1R. It was originally built in 1996 by the UK-based Lola F1 operation. Who they, you may ask? Yep, the team with the shortest-lived Formula One record in history. And brilliantly, the car is the result of a bet between some Lola race engineers who decided it was a bet as to whether they could build an F1 car that you could legally use on the roads. And they have basically built something that is, to all intents and purposes, a Formula One car that you could drive to the shops, drive out for Sunday lunch, or just go drive past schools and make a lot of schoolboys very, very happy.
How much you reckon it's going to go for? What do they reckon?
I think it's about 60 grand, they reckon. But, you know, this is one of those things where you could find that there's lots of people who don't go for it, because how much of a classic is this? Expect to sell between 55 and 85. You know, it's not an in-demand classic. Or you could find that there's one person there. There are people out there with plenty of money, wealthy buyers, who just goes, I want to have that. You have two of them bidding against each other. Could go for much more. We will update you on it after the sale.
Real question, though, is how's it going to navigate speed bumps? Is it all right with that? Or
I would imagine that were you to encounter a speed bump in this car, then you would need to probably turn around and go the other way. So it's not going to be ideal for me. I would be trapped on my own road.
Editor Simon Lambert and reporter Becky Rutt, thank you so much for joining us.